So about a week and a half ago now, I was in San Diego for SDCC, San Diego Comic Con, right?
As one
And
does.
you've been, Dragon Con, all these other conventions, right? They tend to attract the weird ass, like a reactionary street preacher sort of person, right? There's one
I
always
never
one.
got why. Is it just because there's so many queer people who go there, or is it they think it's witchcraft? Is this a satanic panic holdover?
I mean, they're certainly preaching against queer people. This guy that I saw at SDCC had a big like flag on his back saying, "Oh, transgender, oh, homosexuality, lies, all this, that, and the other." Though that being said, they have a pretty feeble presence here at Dragon Con, and even more so at SDCC. There were like maybe two or three of these guys, and they were largely drowned out. But so I was walking past this guy, and he was like, "Are you following the devil? Are you believing his lies?" And just fancy strikes me. I turn around and I go, "Yes." And he goes, "Why are you believing the devil's lies?" And literally, I'm not exaggerating when I say that I did hear him suppress a laugh. I know it's the Reddit like, oh, and then everybody laughed thing, but no, nobody laughed but him. He just didn't expect anybody to answer, and that's
That is funny. No, it's if you had gotten into it, you would have explained by the devil you mean Judge Holden. No, he's actually probably a follower of Judge Holden. If you don't understand that reference, go back a few. No,
Oh,
y'all get it.
I'm gonna see this guy being led around on a leash, no doubt, by a naked man in the desert.
100%. That embodies the spirit of the United States, more or less. I always found it weird that they protest at Comic Cons. I feel like it's like a holdover from like 80s, like D&D scare, like fear of like Dungeons and Dragons and of like role playing games and stuff. I think it's like connected to that because like it's not really like I understand it's obviously awful, but I understand why they're at like Pride events. I don't quite get what the beef is. I think it's got to be. And from what I've seen, it's usually like old guys. I feel like it's just guys who've like, we've been doing this 30 years and the crowd's gotten smaller every year. And here we are. But
It's
I
old
don't know.
guys, and just like tragically nerdy younger guys, and you know what I mean when I say nerdy. Like, I mean, but it's where the people are, pop culture is pop culture is the big mover of crowds,
I mean, speaking of outreach, I literally just got back from some outreach for this event, the International People's Assembly. Look it up if you're interested. Free tickets, all that here in Atlanta. Yeah, it's gonna be awesome. But I was doing outreach for this apartment complex, and honestly, those street preachers—they're some of the best. They would be great at outreach for an actually good cause. Got to recruit a couple of them if we can knock some sense at least into the young ones. But
Give me the
dude.
confidence of that, yeah, of that man, yeah.
Right. Either them or like those like Black Israelite groups, like Sons of Thunder and them. The
Oh God, those
sheer
guys.
audacity is, if nothing else, impressive. But
I saw a
I was,
couple of those guys in Chattanooga just last month.
yeah,
They're
no, it's a popular,
all over in the South.
it's a popular, I think a growing ideology, but I don't
Oh,
honestly
that's
know much
concerning.
about it. Yeah, I don't love the vibes on that, but all that to say, I was outside and dude, the heat is absurd. And I know like here in Georgia where we are is not the like crux of the heat dome. I mean, it's always like it's always warm in Georgia except for like a small amount of the year. And the heat wave's certainly hitting us. We're not at Texas levels. We're not at like West U.S. levels or like
Oh
some of these
boy.
other. But still, like I'm feeling this heat and I'm thinking about this book. And it's like, man, it just you can kind of feel it all around you. And I literally talked with this older guy. And I was like, yeah, it's an event, International People's Assembly. He looked at my flyer and he said, "Is this a socialist event?" And I said, "Sure is." And he said, "So is Fidel Castro speaking?" And I said, "Well, no, I don't believe he will, but if he makes an appearance, we'll allow it." And he said, "Well, you don't want that." And I was wondering what direction he was going with. And I was like, "Well, what do you mean?" He goes, "He's a skeleton, son." And I said, And then, you know, we had a laugh and he goes, no, he goes, honestly, a few years ago, I wouldn't have agreed with you, but it's getting hot out here. I think you folks are going to have your day. And then he walked back inside. And that was like, I don't think he's coming to the event. I don't think that was an endorsement of our ideology, but it was just an acknowledgement of him like having kind of seen stuff, seen the conditions. And he just says, it's hot out here. I think you guys are going to have your day. And I found that to be very interesting and tie in very nicely with this book.
Yes, yes. Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future. And this is a book that you turned me on to a while back. I actually got it for my parents for Christmas this past year. I think they're just now getting into it.
Okay, I'd like to know what they think of that once they've
read it. definitely, because in certain ways, I was just thinking this. Kim Stanley Robinson reminds me of my father. You know, because he's an eternal optimist. He's an eternal optimist. You know, he acknowledges the that what we have today is not all that, but I think he has different ideas than you or I about what we what ought to be done about it. What is to be done?
Sure,
shall we say?
What is to be done, or in his case, probably not what is to be done. This is not Kim Stanley Robinson is not a Leninist. We'll say that. That said, I do. I turned you on to this book, not because I think, and we'll get into it, that it's ideologically pure or even ideologically correct most of the time, but it is so visionary in such a unique way. He describes it as not a utopian, but an anti-dystopian book. And I think that's very interesting. I think that's accurate. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not like we're like Edward Bellamy kind of stuff, like literally just here is what the good world is like. It is a somewhat, at least in his vision, internally consistent, realistic vision of what a good future could be and the arc to get there, including some really, really horrific stuff, which we will talk about. And I appreciate that. I also read this book at a time in my life that I really needed to read this book. This was in 2020. I was working washing dishes in Chili's.
The world had ended.
Yeah, well, yeah, for everyone but us who had to go to work to like make rent. Yeah. It was a time where like the Bernie movement was dead. It was gone at that point. We're rounding the cusp of I want to say it was a point where there was a period during the summer where there was a lot of energy in the streets, and also COVID got a little less bad. And then the energy in the streets died out coming into fall. And the COVID got worse than it had really, I think even worse than it had been originally, at least as bad numbers-wise.
Well, and we're in the middle of another surge now, you know?
Yeah, it certainly not comparable to what it was then, but it was, and I remember I knew people around me. I found out that a former coworker of mine had died of it, like our hospital was turning people away. It was bad. So I was feeling all of this, feeling like, okay, our best case scenario is Joe Biden. At the time, I was convinced Trump was going to win re-election, which, you know, good that he didn't, but also, you know, well, doesn't make all that much difference.
In one sense, yeah, he came close. You know, people, you know, liberals throw around that 40,000 votes figure all the time. But in the other sense, you know, that only makes sense if you treat the Electoral College, if you treat our bourgeois democracy as a given, right?
As super legitimate, right?
Yeah, because again, you know, it's Biden got over 7 million more votes. Yeah, you know, the consensus is clear.
It was a really like dark time for me mentally, and so reading this book and actually listening to it the first time I read it, while I was washing those dishes at Chili's, was very constructive for me.
Yes.
An idea of a constructive future. And even while I'm listening to it, I'm like, well, I don't agree with a lot of this, but the arc it takes and the idea of people coming together to achieve a vision, was meaningful enough for me that I'm not gonna be like, oh, this book saved my life. No, but it was like a genuinely uplifting force for me. That actually kind of got me out of a bit of a rut. And so I love this book a lot, even though you're about to hear me criticize it a lot. So yeah, and the author, I've also, like, my relationship to Kim Stanley Robinson is I've read this, I've listened to a couple interviews, I've read Red Mars, and I've read The Years of Rice and Salt. So I've read a little Kim Stanley Robinson. He's an interesting guy, and we will get more into him because I think Joss has the bio for us.
Yeah, yeah. So Kim Stanley Robinson, he was born the 23rd of March, 1952 in Waukegan. I had to run that pronunciation through
Waukegan Phoenix, I believe.
Yes, Waukegan Phoenix. Yes, the man who played the Joe Keeger.
Yeah, the Joe Keeger. Yeah.
Yes. He moved to Southern California now when he was two, and he actually attributes his trajectory as a science fiction writer to this, at least in part. He says that Southern California has been in a science fictional place for a very long time. This is in a UCTV interview in 2000. I was watching this earlier today. We should drop a link at some point. It's pretty fun watching. So he gets his BA in literature from UCSD in 74. He gets his MA in English from Boston the following year. And by 78, he's moved back to Davis, California. He's working as a bookseller. He's doing some graduate work, teaching composition, some other classes at UC Davis. And it's from UC Davis that he gets his PhD in English. And this is in 1982. It is there that he is advised to read Philip K. Dick. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's his first, brush with science fiction, but it's certainly through an authoritative source. His first PhD advisor, the literary critic Frederick Jameson, turns him on to Dick.
Mm-hmm.
And
immaturely giggling right here. Sorry, go ahead.
It's a word. It's a name. He turns him
on to Dick. That kind of did it for me.
Yes, yeah. He turns him on to the throbbing turgid works of Philip K. Dick. Yes, and
dreaming of something other than electric sheep.
Indeed, yeah. Indeed. He's described Dick as the greatest living American writer at the time. And that's where his doctoral thesis comes from. The novels of Philip K. Dick is Robinson's thesis. And he carries this love of science fiction with him through his career and into the rest of his life. He considers still the new wave of science fiction of the 60s and of the 70s. The peak of that genre, essentially, not to say that it's bad now, but, just that, a lot of the ideas that Robinson himself, I think, traffics in, saw their really first major flowering in that era. It's breaking away from the pulp traditions of the Golden Age. It's sort of interrogating the idea that technological advancement alone, solves civilization's problems, right? The forward march of technology, space colonization, robots, AI, all that. And it's characterized by experimentation with other genres, with other sciences than the physical, social sciences in particular. Out of this tradition, you see coming Ursula K. Le Guin, Philip K. Dick, Roger Zelazny, Harlan Ellison is a big name in this. And it's not long after he gets his MA in 1975, right, when the sort of new wave era is kind of tapering off and he's getting into it, that he starts writing. Mm. And his first stories appear in volume 18 of Orbit, which is an anthology series edited by the writer and critic Damon Knight. Now, Orbit 18 appears to have been a strong volume. Robinson's stories In Pearson's Orchestra and Coming Back to Dixieland appear, along with R.A. Lafferty's The Hand with 100 Fingers, Kate Wilhelm's Ladies and Gentlemen, This Is Your Crisis, as well as a story called Meat House Man, written by a guy called George R.R. Martin. Maybe you've heard of him.
I have indeed. I saw a picture of him earlier today going to Barbie wearing pink, and I thought that looks like a Meat House Man right there.
Conspicuously not writing Winds of Winter, yes.
Conspicuously, yes.
Now, this loudly. I thought was incredible. This I thought was incredible. I've never read Orbit 18, but I have read, as it happens, one of its stories, Rules of Moops Ball by Gary mm-hmm. Cohn.
Yeah.
And readers, I encourage you to look this up. It's the rules of this bizarre cocktail of rugby and medieval warfare. The author was inspired by a Mad Magazine article from 1965 about this nonsensical sport called 43-man Squamish. And, it sort of gives you an insight into the dialogue, the literary dialogues happening here, because it's actually mentioned in Gene Wolfe's novel, There Are Doors, from 1988.
Really?
Which all is. Yeah. Yeah. And indeed, Robinson cites Wolfe as a major influence on him. Wolf died back in 2018, I believe. We should do one of his books at some point.
No doubt. Philip K. Dick, too, while we're at it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I actually have yet to get into Dick, but maybe this year it will change.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Now, so Black Air is a novella by Kim Stanley Robinson. It appears in F&SF, what's the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, in 1983. And it wins the World Fantasy Award for Best Novella the following year, his first and only. I say only, just his only World Fantasy Award, because he's gone on to win 6 Locuses, 3 Nebulas, 2 Hugos, the Robert A. Heinlein Award, that's Lifetime Achievement Award. In 2018, he wins another one, an Arthur C. Clarke Award for Imagination in Service to Society.
Wow.
Imagination in Service to Society. Which,
was there a specific book he won that for? Was it for this one?
No, it was his entire body of work.
Just, okay, it was, makes sense.
Yeah, he wouldn't write it for another couple of years. But this was interesting to me because it was actually, he actually won it the same year that Omar El-Akkad was nominated for an Arthur C. Clarke for American War.
Interesting.
Yeah. Very different.
Put a pin in that because there's definitely some parallels between the novels.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and therein you see the goal of our podcast, right? We're actually trying to create a coincidence nexus powerful enough to resurrect Charles Dickens, right?
That's the idea.
And then we can have him on the pod.
There you go.
We'll talk about Little Dorrit or something.
Yeah, he'll come on. He'll come on and be like, yeah, so everything's good now. We got rid of y'all got a good society now. We're like, we're gonna need you to conjure up some ghosts, Charles. It's gonna be necessary for a lot of people.
Mm. Mm. Yes, yes. And so he's won a smattering of other awards. Robinson, not Dickens. He's won a smattering of other awards, domestic and foreign. Half of them are for his Mars trilogy, for which he is best known. Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars. Those came out in 92, 93, and 96, respectively. And he'd written on Mars previously in 1984's Icehenge, his second published novel. But, you know, human civilization thereon was established, and it was more of a backdrop to a story about, you know, how historical narratives are produced and whatnot. This is a story about the colonization and the terraforming of the planet Mars, right? And the upheaval that goes into that. You know, it's wild. You know, it is wild.
Yes.
You've read Red Mars, not the second two.
I meant to, and I just never did. But it's very. I mean, to say it's an ambitious trilogy is an understatement. The amount of things he's working with are, and the ideas and his attention to science, because he loves the science, not just in the sense of like abstractly, but he's thinking very literally about how these things work. Even if the science isn't externally possible, though a lot of it is, internally he's got this incredibly elaborate view of how all the machines work. Some writers, when they write, sci-fi writers, and like, you know, Asimov, I don't think Asimov really cares, you know, right when he's writing sci-fi, what's making the rocket go. And that's fine. Robinson cares immensely what's making the rocket go. And every gear and everyone and everybody's job on the ship, you can tell he wants that level of granular detail. And he does his homework. To an impressive extent. And that carries over to this book.
He says there's a point in that UCSD interview back from 2000, the video one, where he says that, you don't see the mighty mountain ranges necessarily that you see on Earth on Mars, because Mars doesn't have, you know, so much granite that we have. Mars doesn't have the tectonic action that we have, you know, and that's his frame of reference. Right. And, you know, he kind of combines his own experience there, because his sort of inspiration for writing the Mars trilogy was he looked at a photograph of Mars and he was like, you know what? That'd be a fun place to go backpacking.
Mm-hmm.
He's an avid backpacker, is Robinson. It's funny, James Cameron used to own the rights to the series back in the 90s, the adaptation rights. And at one point
of the Mars trilogy?
Of the Mars trilogy, yes. Yeah. James Cameron's Mars trilogy, if you can imagine that.
That would be pretty cool.
It would be, but it didn't get off the ground. It didn't get off the ground with the Sci-Fi Channel. It didn't get off the ground with AMC back in 2008. Spike TV actually greenlit a season one in 2015. J. Michael Straczynski of Babylon 5 was going to be the showrunner, and he left due to creative differences. His replacement left, and you know the project has stalled since then. But Green Mars and the cover of Red Mars, so the content of Green Mars and the cover artwork for Red Mars, they were on board NASA's Phoenix probe in 2008. So if and when people get there, you know, they can read it and see, yeah, look how far we've come.
Yeah. And then they'll have a blueprint of what to do.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. An exact precise blueprint. And this is a good place, I think, to get into Robinson, the environmentalist, because he writes extensively about ecology and of political economy and where they intersect. And so before he wrote the Mars trilogy, he wrote the Southern California trilogy, or the Three Californias trilogy, the Wild Shore, the Gold Coast, Pacific Edge. It's three possible futures of Orange County, where he lives, as disaster novel, dystopia, and utopia, right? And you get in all three of those, at least from the beginning, as I've come to understand it, sort of a it starts with an excavation, right, in all three. You know, for the Wild Shore, right, which is the disaster novel, right, you know, you're digging up coffins to strip the silver off of them to use for to use for scrap metal to sell. Gold Coast, right, you're digging as like an archaeological kind of expedition just to figure out, you know, where you came from. Pacific Edge, right, you're digging stuff up to use for recycling, right? So, you know, three sort of approaches to how you interact with your environment, you know, whether it's for something constructive or whether it's for curiosity's sake, for, you know, this, that, and the other. You know, he's in constant conversation with the human environment and with the environment of the world. And he quotes Virginia Woolf in that interview that I mentioned. One test of a novel for the writer is how easily it lets you say what you wanted to say anyway. Right. And he said that in reference to the Mars trilogy. He describes this as the perfect match for him on that front. And he agrees that his characters represent ideas as much as themselves, if not more. Right. And that comes through in what's driving the journey to Mars. And that comes through in what drives eventually the liberation struggle of Mars. Right. Earth is undergoing irreversible climate change. It's a climate disaster, a volcanic eruption below Western Antarctica, actually, that drives the second rebellion of Mars, the one that succeeds. Mm-hmm. Right. And the technology of terraforming this new planet is front and center.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's all his books, not even just sci-fi, because like The Years of Rice and Salt is not a science fiction novel in the same way as one of these. In fact, most of it takes place in the past. It's just a history where Europe basically is completely destroyed by the Black Plague. 99% of Europe, or 99.8, it's some absurd number. There's like a couple guys who live, is destroyed, and history goes differently. And even then, he's very interested in this intersection of, okay, what would happen to like the crops? Mm-hmm. What would happen to, you know, he even like notes that there's these cold years from the amount of carbon that was coming from those people being wiped out. You know, he wants to note exactly the way diseases would move in this new setup, and what currents would be the most important. And yeah, rice and salt, this actual fixation on these commodities that are moving around. He strikes me as a guy who's not necessarily a Marxist, but would love to read Capital for the parts about the cloth. Like it's a really like just the detail about economy, about ecology, about sociology. Like he has this, you could tell he just likes to think about systems moving.
Yes.
And everything he writes is like this. And Ministry for the Future, unlike these other books, he is able to bring it home in an incredibly extreme way. He has books. I mean, plenty of his books are set on Earth, but he's able to bring it home in the like, not just theoretical way, but also in the idea of, hey, here's some things we could do. This is almost in parts a book of him giving suggestions, a book of him writing. I wouldn't call it theory, but like bordering fiction with some like theory underlining it, with some outline, some nonfiction in parts. I've heard people call this the best nonfiction sci-fi I ever read, because like that is very much how it feels. And the level of detail his science goes into as well.
Well, yeah, and, you know, because it's speculative by nature, you know, and you know, you have to have a foundation to speculate from, and he has, and it's he really gets into the granularity of his science and of the economics underlying what he's presenting to us here, which is why it's oddly, he comes at political economy, I think, from an oddly reductionist stance.
That's true.
To get into it from the Mars trilogy, it's mentioned in one of his interviews, the character of Vlad Tenayev during the Martian Constitutional Convention, right? He describes capitalism as a form of feudalism, right? In which mm-hmm. capital replaces land and business leaders replace kings. And Robinson describes it as one of the, he, you know, when he's talking about how characters represent ideas pretty explicitly in his work, right? He characterizes Vlad's pronouncement here as one of the more direct statements of his own political beliefs, mm-hmm. right? He says, you know, and, you know, I'm guilty of invoking the whole divine right of kings argument when people say, oh, you know, the technocrats will solve us. But, you know, the, he doesn't appear to see capitalism as, you know, and of course capitalism is bad and it should be overthrown, but he doesn't appear to see it as a historically progressive step from feudalism. You know, he says, well, you know, you look at capitalism, you look at feudalism, fundamentally, it's still a minority of people controlling controlling the resources, right?
Right. And the way we would explain that differently is we would say it's a class. We would say it, the similarity is the class domination, and it yes. is a minority class. There are differences in the way that it works. They are not one-to-ones. Now, if it's a useful way for you to understand class society, if feudalism is an easier way to explain it, and then you can take a further step to explain capitalism, sure. But the idea that they're the same in some capacity is, it's reductionist. It's just not the case.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, and again, you know, he, as we'll get into, you know, he believes in what he describes late in the book. And again, you know, he's being an optimist here. He doesn't say that this is what will happen, right? But the prescription that he kind of lays out here is a revolution without a revolution, right?
Yeah.
You know, when the powers that be are essentially compelled, forced by well, a multiplicity of factors to essentially do the rational and correct thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, he's a card carrying, dues paying DSA member. I don't know what that says because DSA is such a big tent organization. You know, I think we have a lot more to agree with him about than to disagree.
No doubt.
But like the article that I sent you, paying ourselves to decarbonize, right, which he wrote earlier this year, like he argues that, you know, starting from the figure of, yeah, you know, 3/4 of the world's oil reserves, right, are owned by nation states, right? You know, he argues that petrostates have to be compensated for the income lost from turning from fossil fuels. You know, he says, well, you know, the problem isn't with bankrupting fossil fuel companies by taking away their subsidies, by levying lots of tax. The problem is that, you know, petrostates, right, countries that rely on fossil fuels would collapse right away, you know, because he says, well, you know, the people in charge of these states are trying to do right by their people fundamentally, you know, in terms of sticking to this. And I mean, he acknowledges that they have to disappear, right? He acknowledges that, oh, I mean, in his own words, right, roughly 2,600 gigatons of carbon simply cannot be burned into the atmosphere. Biophysical reality says those assets must be stranded. Mm-hmm. Economic reality says that can't be done without causing a super depression. And that's where, you know, I kind of break with him, right? Because we don't believe in compensation.
You know, well, I think we would take it a step further, right? It would cause a super depression under capitalism. Therefore, the climate crisis cannot be solved.
Yes, precisely.
That's the logic. And he would say he would probably say yes, but he would disagree that the transition from capitalism to socialism needs to be revolutionary. I think he thinks it can be sort of phased into it via like good legislation. I mean, I think he believes in these like this long transitory period between capitalism and socialism in a different way than a literal changing hands of class power. And I think that's where we would disagree. But it'll be a little easier to talk about this in context of the book. Do you have any more details on him as just life, bio, anything like that before we just get into the plot itself? Because this compensation bit is, you know, an integral part of the plot.
I mean, not really. I mean, there's an asteroid that's named after him in 2001.
That landed in the Vonnegut crater.
Oh my God.
There you go. The Unity. Yeah.
Still the most ambitious crossover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Time Magazine named him a hero of the environment in 2008 for, you know, his optimistic sort of vision of the future. I think it's perhaps not so it's not so difficult to understand why, because he doesn't really advocate for a revolutionary changing of changing of hands the way we understand it. But I'm, again, you know, his reading of utopia as a process rather than an end goal is, you know, he bases his worldview on that. And I think that at least is fundamentally correct, right?
Sure.
You know, the process of building that sort of thing involves a lot of contradictions, a lot of setbacks. And, you know, on that we can agree. It's just a bit perplexing that, you know, the imagination that he brings to the table doesn't extend to an overthrow of existing property relations, but, you know,
sure, he is, you know, again, to his credit, he advocates, and if you like read some stuff he's written or like outside of fiction, and also you listen to interviews, he advocates relentlessly local organizing. He's like, we have to organize locally.
Yes.
And he talks about elections, but he says beyond that, like, he says, like, you know, I listened to his interview with Rev Left Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about how, like, we need people showing up to council meetings and then meeting each other and organizing and forming councils that then run things ourselves and whatever. And he talks about that. He talks about how, like, there needs to be this focus on the local level that then these local organizations can link up and create national and international power. Like, he's got the right idea of a lot of the work that needs to be done.
He believes in building people power. Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%. And so, like you said, we're on board with, you know, a lot of what he wants to do. We're very much on board with a lot of what his world he envisions looks like and a lot of the provisions people have. It's just because this is a novel of extreme transition. It's described as like this novel is like the time of troubles from which a greater world is able to emerge. A revolution without a revolution. It is impossible for us not to sort of bang up against some of these difficulties between us and him. That said, you know, like I said, really enjoyed the novel and I think he's a cool guy. Listened to a few interviews with him that I've enjoyed. Rev Left Radio has a good interview with him. And, you know, not to plug podcasts that are way bigger than ours. But Rev Left Radio or Chapo Trap House both had him on. They're both solid interviews, very different interviews. but I listened to those two, and he's a, you know, him talking it up with people more radical than him was an interesting thing, because they kind of were like, well, why is there less revolution in this? Why is there less whatever? Not really the questions that he's getting asked by like Time or whatever. And he says in one of them very honestly, he goes, listen, I acknowledge what probably has to happen, but I wanted to write a story of a future in which it doesn't need to.
Yes.
And I find that very interesting. He sees this as the best possible outcome. Mm-hmm. He basically sees this as the best possible realistic outcome that could happen. Chillest is a weird word, but the way things go the best without the most upheaval, without the most death and destruction, both environmentally and interpersonally. There's no World War III in this book, but you know, and he acknowledges, yeah, there probably will be. That, like, that's a thing he says is very likely. So it's also worth noting that this is not exactly his guidebook to exactly everything that he thinks is going to happen, but this is a sort of a step-by-step idea of what could happen with a lot of imagination there. But we can get into the plot. The book is kicked off by one of the most horrifying few chapters I've ever read in anything. I mean, just genuinely, the amount of people online who just did not get past the first three chapters of this book, not because it was bad, but because it was too visceral. There's a lot of people I found, and the people I've met as well, who just said they could not get through it because it is about a massive and just heat wave in India that kills, I don't know the exact number, but more people than World War I.
20 million.
In the space of a week. And he gets into pretty decent detail. And indeed, I've looked into it, why this is a perfectly possible scenario, but by 2030 or 2040.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, you know, he uses the phrase wet bulb a few times in the course of this. And for those of you who don't know, wet bulb conditions refer to the confluence of heat and humidity, whereby the air is so saturated with moisture that your body actually physically struggles to cool. Like, your sweat doesn't evaporate, right? And at that point, right, if you're outside in that shit, you can be in the shade, you can be in front of a fan, you can be constantly drinking water, you're still fucked. And you know, again, to linger here in the real world a bit, India, one in four of the households have air conditioning, right? So you have to think, okay, in 20 years, given current trends, right, 1 billion people globally are on track to experience 10 days of such conditions annually, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is a picture of what that looks like. And it's really necessarily, because there's nothing else in the book that is this visceral, but it's necessarily visceral because it's, you know, it illustrates the immediacy of the problem, especially for, you know, the global South, especially for the tropics. And nowhere is that, it's encapsulated pretty cleanly in the very first sentence of the book. It was getting hotter.
It's also wet bulb temperature is when this came out. And like I said, I read this book almost immediately after it came out, like a month or two after it came out, must've been, I think that's right. But the wet bulb temperature was not a term I'd ever heard before. I've now seen it actually used multiple times talking about current heat waves, because this is a live thing that is developing, this idea of this temperature that can literally kill you as a combination of humidity and heat.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, if you've ever been in a very hot, very humid place, you understand, you can kind of get an idea of what that would be like. But it has this incredibly visceral description of this mass death in India as power fails, because like you said, there's already a lack of air conditioning. The grid is weak and the grid tries to pull it off, but it fails. And you have it through the perspective of this guy, Frank. Now, Frank is an American who is visiting India on basically a humanitarian mission. And he's there. And he's working in this medical center, and they've got air conditioning and they're packing people in. He's chugging water and he's sort of sweating and deteriorating. He sees everything falling apart around him and things in things burning and people are robbing each other and it's getting crazy. It refers to the city as a morgue. It says this air feels like an oven. They eventually flee when power totally fails to just jump in a lake, and they all just boil to death in a lake. Frank being the only survivor, just due to having had a more upper class life, having a more, you know, more robust physical body, even though he is very close to death, and spends the rest of his life just having horrible PTSD flashes, thinking about the heat, thinking about those experiences. And you get this moment of 20 million dead, the world having to deal with the cause of climate change in an incredibly visceral way. And this is really the event that makes this world different than ours. This is the one where this is like the big kickoff, because this is the event that makes it possible for the reader to imagine some action being taken. Because as Kim Stanley Robbins acknowledges, it's hard right now without such an event to imagine even action on the scale of early in the novel being taken. And this is how he explains it.
Yeah, and this is where the first crack in the foundation, you know, not that it brings down the whole edifice, right? But this is where the first crack in the foundation started for me. And it may just be anecdotal, right? It may just be lingering doomerism on my part, because again, how many people were displaced in the past year by flooding in Pakistan? How many millions of people when the glaciers were melting there, right? You were just telling me earlier, 140 degree temperatures in the Persian Gulf, right? Necessitating, yeah, you know, people staying in. It's and again, you know, you had to look at these things across the timeline in which they happen, you know. But it's astonishing to me to see something, you know, not quite on this scale, but getting there. And, you know, it just makes you impatient.
Sure. I do think there is a difference. I think 20 million people dying would have an effect, maybe not identical to the one in this. I think maybe a more extreme effect than the reaction to some other or non-reaction to some other climate catastrophes we've seen. Mm-hmm. Like, I do think more people dying in a week than in World War I would have a genuine, like, jarring effect on the globe. It certainly would have effect on the internal politics of India, if nothing else.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no single event, I think, has had that scale. You're right.
Yeah, so the scale of the event, I think that's why. I mean, what year is this? I think it's like 2025.
2025.
Yeah, getting there. And Yeah, so it's just this really just, and I'm trying to figure out like a great quote to pull from it, but it is just long stuff talking about like his limbs were like cooked spaghetti draping his bones. And he said the air was hotter than the water. He's in the water and he just really wants to flee the water because it feels like a sauna. And he's got this, just this awful,
I found awful one
experience. Yeah. Read it.
Let's see. The day passed. Wails of grief were now muffled to groans. People were too hot and thirsty to make any fuss, even when their children died. Red eyes and brown faces staring at Frank as he stumbled among them, trying to help get corpses of family members up onto the roof where they scorched in the sun. Bodies would be rotting, but maybe they would anneal and dry out before that. It was so hot. No odors could survive in this heat. Only the smell of scorched, steamy air itself. Or maybe not. Sudden smell of rotting meat.
It is just, it's brutal and visceral.
It's interesting to start to zoom out. On the previous page, he's mugged for his AC unit. He's broken entered and robbed for his AC unit, I should say. And the man with the gun scowled. He pointed the gun at Frank one last time. "You did this," he said. And then they slammed the door on him and were gone, which in microcosm, you know, you see the sort of, you see that sort of resentment that, India correctly brings to the global stage in the next few chapters, is that look, you know, the biggest polluters here are the West, and now the global South, you know, the factories of the world are paying the price.
No doubt. I mean, there's a quote I really like from a little later on. India had been told to get better without any financial help to do so whatsoever, told to tighten the belt and embrace austerity and be the working class for the bourgeoisie of the developed world and suffer in silence until better times came. But the better times could never come. That plan was shot. The deck had been stacked. The game was over. And now 20 million people were dead. So you're in this place where they're basically having a Paris Climate Accord style or meeting, and the people of India are saying like no one met their targets. And someone points out India hadn't met their targets. But the thing is, India is only now trying to catch up with the wealth of the developed world. And most of the carbon they're burning is to ship to developed countries, the stuff they're making. So, you know, people aren't even factoring that in. But what's notable is that India, while all the other countries, not all of them forget, but there's a lot of forgetting that goes around, a lot of promises and a lot of forgetting, India makes a change, makes a genuine change. A new party is brought into power called the Survival Party. And they are, and they basically set up it gets described multiple ways, but it's a communalist government, a socialist government, different ways that it gets called. One person calls it green communism at one point, and the guy goes, yeah. Like he just says, yes. And they basically say, we are the working class of the world. We are 1/5 of the global world, and you are going to see what we can do. And there's a more radical sect that's both in their politics and operating in the shadows called the Children of Kali. Kali being, you know, Hindu goddess, right? And also, you know, in reference to the region where the burning happened. But they say basically, you know, if you do not meet these goals that were promised, then you will face the wrath of this 1/5 of the world. You will face, you know, our attacks. And they mean that economically, but they also mean that if not in the open air, India going to war with people, the Children of Kali conducting covert operations to fucking off billionaires, basically.
And yes. And as well, you know, India as a state actor, because there are it's brought up geoengineering clauses in the Paris agreements and the subsequent treaties that build on them, right, that prevents one or another country from unilaterally engaging in these sort of geoengineering projects as India is now undertaking in this book. And they literally just say, yeah, we're breaking the agreement, you know, and they do this atmospheric seeding, as an example, to essentially try and force a short term reduction in global temperatures, a double Pinatubo, as they call it, Pinatubo, referring to the to this volcano that erupted several decades ago and actually led to a global sort of blip downwards.
And this is a real strategy using usually carbon silicate or something like that. It's been discussed and researched. There's disagreement on whether it would work or not. There's also disagreement on whether it would work a little too well. The movie Snowpiercer is literally about this going poorly. No serious scientist thinks that would happen, but there is discussion over what it would do to weather patterns, over what it would do to, you know, air currents, all that kind of crazy stuff. What it would do if we were breathing in all this stuff, the sheer amount that it would be necessary. But it's worth noting, if we get to the point where we are having heat waves in real life that kill 10 to 20 million people, there is no telling what governments will do very quickly to try to remain in power.
Mm-hmm.
And the honest truth is, we don't know what solutions will be rushed to. This is a very real possibility. The Gates Foundation is actually currently conducting research on this kind of, geoengineering being the word.
This is where I think, because Robinson's case study for such drastic course corrections is the nationalization of the Bank of England during the Second World War, particularly during the Blitz, right? You know, the state takes control of it and says, okay, we're going to use it for these war expenditures. I don't disrespect the because as you say, you know, there is precedent for this, right? There's real world, there's people looking into exactly what sort of course corrections would be needed. I think it's just the wrong case study because, you know, Britain, I think, was defending its primacy at that moment. You know, I think the existential threat to Britain is a little overstated because, you know, again, what Britain was defending was its ability to export its contradictions to the rest of its empire. But, you know, I think there is something to all this.
I guess as a comparison of like just radical times call for radical measures kind of
yes,
thing,
yes.
Whatever those radical times may be, whether it be a legitimate threat or a threat to capital, it is a threat of severe enough size that the state decides to do something very, very radical indeed. Like, mm-hmm. I still think it's kind of a strange comparison, but, you know, so it is. But
yeah,
this is a live thing that's been constructed.
Ultimately, I think probably a semantic quibble on my part, right? Because because we all agree objectively, nothing's more existential than climate change at this point,
right? And it's an interesting thing. There's so many of things like that. This book is so big, and there's so many perspectives. And it's worth noting, we didn't really say this, you might have picked up on it by now, there's no fixed perspective in this book. It can jump mm-hmm. to any narrator or no narrator. It could be third. It's all third person. Not all third person. That's not true.
There's
mostly third person.
There's also from the perspective of inanimate objects.
Yeah.
Well.
Or there's riddles. Yeah.
There's the second chapter here after the big old heat wave.
Yeah. Read the second chapter.
Yeah. It's very, very short. And it's really striking. I am a god and I am not a god. Either way, you are my creatures. I keep you alive. Inside, I am hot beyond all telling, and yet my outside is even hotter. At my touch, you burn, though I spin outside the sky. As I breathe my big, slow breaths, you freeze and burn, freeze and burn. Someday, I will eat you. For now, I feed you. Beware my regard. Never look at me. It's from the perspective, of course, of Chuck Norris.
Yeah, no, it's actually inside I'm hot beyond all telling, and yet my mm-hmm. outside is even hotter was referring to me, I thought.
You know, when the sea level rises, you know, it means Chuck Norris is coming over your coast, right? Mm-hmm.
Chuck Norris is not a name I've heard in a long time, I have to say.
This has been a dispatch from the internet in 2005. No, it's
absolutely.
The sun. It's the sun from whose perspective that this chapter is.
It says, I am a god,
and
even though I'm not a god.
It's worth noting, a little later in the book, you find out, it's not directly stated, but, you know, you infer that, you find out, and you're meant to infer that this chapter is actually written by Frank. It's a cognitive behavioral therapy sort of thing that he's going through where, okay, write this from the perspective of this aspect of your environment, right? You know, to sort of square yourself in relation to it, right? And of course, yeah, right now, when the sun has killed 20 million people, it's short, it's sweet. I mean, it's not sweet. It's actually quite bitter, but, you know, you feel very small, but you'll find, I think you find throughout, as you hear from protons, as you hear from
I think a hydrogen atom.
A hydrogen atom
is in there. Yeah.
These things, you know, these little digressions do get more conversational and do get a little more fanciful. So, you know, you do see this healing process reflected in this unconventional sort of prose.
Yeah, you've got little bits like that. You'll have parts where the book basically stops and does an essay on like political economy or science.
It reminded me a little bit of have you read Cory Doctorow?
No, I've not.
He's got a book called For the Win, which is pretty interesting. It's about basically online, you know, online economies, and I think it gets a little bit of into a cryptocurrency. It's been half a lifetime since I've read it, but yeah, he too will digress for chapters, just talk directly to the reader about arbitrage, right?
Sure.
Economies of MMORPGs, right?
Right. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's and it absolutely works for the sort of book that this is.
The book will spend time as well. It'll do little things like it'll just have a character like a back and forth, like a transcript of a conversation. The book is not worried about the limitations of form, of setting. It will go anywhere. It will spend a chapter with a character and never return to him again. And honestly, some of those are like, I think, the strongest parts of the book. Like they'll have little bits. Like it'll just be, here's one chapter of a woman who lives in LA and there's a horrifying storm that destroys the entire city and she spends time saving people and you don't return to that. But it's, you know, views from on the ground, and then we'll zoom out to a million feet up in the air and it'll say the people of the United States reacted to the destruction of LA in different ways, you know, and it can do that. It'll zoom into a refugee camp and they'll be liberated, and then zoom out. The Union of African States was formed, a nationalized industry. And then you're like, okay, I guess that's what that was. And you can see Kim Stanley Robinson honestly having a lot of fun, I think, with some of this perspective. That said, most of the book is spent, if not most, in like a plurality based on character, is spent inside the head of one Mary Murphy. If there's a protagonist, it's her and it's Frank, are sort of two protagonists, I'd say. And Mary is a Irish woman, you know, very smart government person, you know, government agent, and she has been put in charge of the titular organization for this novel, the Ministry for the Future, the Ministry for the Future. Basically, the idea is the UN forms a body that's a sort of advisory, but it does have some resources, and it is going to protect future generations, future life on the planet, because there is no one to speak for the children or the children's children or every generation to come. The Ministry for the Future will speak for them, which basically makes their entire job stopping climate change and war. Primarily climate change, the war does like play a role in it. And she is given this organization, but it's the United Nations. It's, you know, authorized through like Paris Accords. Like, it doesn't really have any teeth. So she has to be, you know, super diplomat. She has to be a character out of like an Aaron Sorkin wet dream, essentially, to be in this. She has to be like every character in the West Wing on steroids, something along those lines. She has to be the best negotiator and the smartest, and work with the resources as best way she has. And I do genuinely like the character of Mary a lot, even if like, you know, I'm making fun of the concept right now, but I still think, I think she's cool. I think she's interesting. I think they allow there to be this interesting woman who is this careerist that becomes this real like radical sort of throughout it, and in has these contradictory opinions, and she does believe in systems, but she hates the systems, and it's an interesting thing. There's a lot going on, and her arc is, I find, very interesting.
Yes. You know, the sort of person who, you know, you wish would be in the room talking to these bankers, these captains of industry, you know, all these people who find themselves now in the position of having to use their significant capital and resources and institutional power for something good and rational, you know. And if she does if you're reading this and you're thinking, huh, she seems to do the work of three people, it's because she's a composite character from three existing people. You know, you have you have a French economist who was the France's special representative for the 2015 COP21 climate change conference. You have a Costa Rican diplomat who was the executive secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change at one point. You have Mary Robinson, who was about 20 years ago the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. You know, people who move in these circles of significant authority.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, actually. It made me think of this. I just read the former head of the UN Climate Change Commission just said, I made a statement saying, I believed we could work with fossil fuel companies. I now no longer believe that. We have to make a complete break from them. We have to treat them as the enemy, which I found to be very interesting and sound like something out of this book, like of someone in that place, even though they are in an institution that, you know, ostensibly is a bourgeois institution, having a moment of personal realization and then acting from that place, and whether or not is necessarily a correct way of viewing political economy and history and whatever, it definitely makes for an interesting character. It makes for her interpersonal, her frustration running up against walls and running up against people who should just know better and don't. And she's got this temper on her, and I enjoy seeing, you know, that run up against each other. I also want to note, you also have this character who is, and I know it's not really the point, but you have this character who's like a middle-aged woman who's allowed to be just a middle-aged woman and be a protagonist, and romance is not very integral to the novel, and she's allowed to be just this female character that is very strong, I think. And I think that there's like props for that as well. She's an interesting like female character, this middle-aged woman, where you don't actually see, you don't see a whole lot of like middle-aged women in this kind of like science fiction setting. And I think that's cool. And I think she's got a great perspective. I also want to note though, like her main, like thing that kicks her off, that makes her break with what she's supposed to be doing, which is like basically serving these governments, and covering for them, which is, I think, what they imagined she'd be doing, is she interacts with Frank. And Frank has basically, he's lost his mind for the most part. He knows he's not completely insane, but he has experienced so much panic and so much fear and so much terror and so much physical stress. And he's just been wandering around Switzerland attacking people.
he goes at one point before this even to, he finds the leaders of the Children of Kali.
Yeah, he goes back to them. Yeah.
He tracks them down and he's like, look, you know, whatever you want me to do, I'll do it. And they're like, we don't need you.
There's an interesting, it made me think of I think Wretched for the Earth, Fanon says, like, this book can be read by people in the first world, but just know you are on the outside looking in, this is not for you. And it made me think of that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah essentially, you know, like it's no matter, he can't undo necessarily his position in all this, you know. And so he spends the rest of the book with his survivor's guilt, with his PTSD. We'll get into that. First, he tries to abduct Mary and get her to basically do more, right?
And this was also after, he had already at this point attacked a rich kid and killed him on accident, I believe.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, for which there was a warrant out for his arrest in Switzerland. He is already a wanted man at the point of this abduction taking place. Yeah, okay, so here in chapter 25... is Frank and Mary's kidnapping plot, right? And he tells her, there's actually, I think I've highlighted this here, it isn't working. You're trying, but it isn't enough. You're failing. You and your organization are failing in your appointed task, and so millions will die. You're letting them down. Every day you let them down, you set them up for death. You know, and here's, and again, you can kind of see why he would feel that way. But again, I mean, we were talking just the other day, right, about, you know, the difference between various types of organizations and how, you know, one doesn't necessarily have to become another, right? Because there's already the Children of Kali, right? You know, carrying out these terroristic acts, right? But it's out of this situation. That Mary sort of draws the conclusion that, okay, well, perhaps there does need to be a black wing, quote unquote, right, of the Ministry for the Future, right? And she goes to one of her colleagues, Badiam, a man from Nepal, and says, hey, you know, what do you think of this idea? And he was like, oh, I thought you already knew about it. Yeah. Come to find out there is one already.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's carrying out, you know, sabotage. We don't necessarily get, is the Black Wing of the Ministry the Children of Kali? Is it something different?
It's, I think the Children of Kali are one of the bits of the Black Wing. Because obviously you have, I mean, way later down the line, Badiam goes to the Children of Kali later in the book.
Yes.
And he just says, I'm Kali. You know, like, but he, I don't think it's necessarily them doing all these actions, but you'll have actions throughout the book where like air travel is completely suspended for pretty much forever by plane because of this mass drone attacks on planes. And it doesn't say straight up, this was an attack by the Ministry for the Future's Black Wing, but it probably was. You don't have, there's a part in the novel where fishing boats are getting attacked for mass destruction of water, of oceans. And it doesn't say that this is funded by the Black Wing, but it very likely is. There's an attack on beef.
And notably, yeah, as well, you know, it's as you say, beef, fishing boats, right? It's directed at very specific components of the world, what's the word that I'm looking for? Of the fossil fuel based infrastructure, essentially, because it's never the planes that run on sustainable fuel that are brought down, right? It's only the ones that are burning fossil fuels.
They blow up a lot of. They say they blow up a lot of coal. Like a lot of coal plants have issues. There's a situation that the beef one is interesting. They give mad cow disease. They inject it into a lot of cows and they don't know which ones have it. And they say, hey, y'all can keep eating beef. Just so you know, you might get mad cow disease. And it forces Americans for the most part in the world to abandon beef. Things like that are being done on a large scale. And you can feel it, the book doesn't pay a lot of attention to it really. And you can feel Kim Stanley Robinson being pretty uncomfortable with these bits. He enjoys writing about the, like, making the new global currency a lot more than he likes writing about this.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about American War last pod. Omar El-Akkad's version of this book would be very different, just the way, same way American War by Kim Stanley Robinson would be a very different book. In fact, I'd be interested to see their takes on both these stories. But it's, you know, Omar El-Akkad, the last podcast, we were saying, hey, in American War, we don't, What's the deal with the, what's the class relationship here? Who's running the factories? We would know all about that if Kim Stanley Robinson was writing this book. But in this book, Omar El-Akkad, if he was writing it, would probably spend a lot of time explaining how, like, the drones were working and stuff. And that's just how it goes.
Yeah.
Though it is interesting. And I do have a lot of questions about the Black Wing. They're just not that they're not answered though.
Yeah. And fundamentally, you know, because I think it's because Omar El-Akkad is much more focused on the intimacy of this stuff, right? He's much more focused on how these momentous sort of actions can be the results of smaller events, of smaller traumas eventually driving somebody to set off a chain of dominoes, right? But that's the thing. And again, you know, Robinson doesn't necessarily need to get into it, I don't think. He says right here at the end of chapter 28, right? He sums it up pretty well. If there are other secret actors influencing human history, as maybe there are, we don't know about them. We very seldom get glimpses of them if they exist. They may be just stories we tell ourselves, hoping that things might make sense, have an explanation, and so on. But no, things don't make sense like that. The stories of secret actors are the secret action. And that's the thing, right? He says, and I tend to agree, you know, don't focus on, you know, don't focus on the, I don't want to say bad actors, but, like, you know, the unpredictables, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they exist in this environment that, you know, we have the power to act on. And that's what we should focus on. And in fact, actually, so a little before that, my favorite chapter, or one of my favorites, actually, I want to share here, chapter 20, I think, summarizes his thesis pretty well. It's where he's laying out the various indices for human development, for human happiness, for physical quality of life, you know, and where they fall short, like the Gini coefficient or, you know, GDP, the Genuine Progress Indicator, the Human Development Index. He lists like 20 of these. And he says here right at the end, you know, All these indexes are attempts to portray civilization in our time using the terms of the hegemonic discourse, which is to say economics, often in the attempt to make a judo-like transformation of the discipline of economics itself, altering it to make more human, make it more human, more adjusted to the biosphere, and so on. Not a bad impulse, but it's important also to take this whole question back out of the realm of quantification, sometimes to the realm of the human and the social, to ask what it all means, what it's all for, to consider the axioms we are agreeing to live by, to acknowledge the reality of other people and of the planet itself, to see other people's faces, to walk outdoors and look around. And this is where I think he's getting the aim here, is, as you say, you know, he zooms down and there's somebody in the middle of the $30 trillion wrecking of LA. He zooms back out, and this is what the United States is galvanized to do. He zooms into Africa, he zooms out of Africa. He zooms into China, he zooms out of China. And what he's doing here, I think, is trying to demystify world events, right? He's trying to say, hey, look, you know, these are the product of people shaped by their environments, of people shaped by their interactions with other people, of people forced out of, you know, whatever bubble they might have crafted for themselves, or not even a bubble, you know, this home they've carved out for themselves in the landscape of the world. These are people forced out of that, and being forced to answer the question of what happens next, and doing a whole lot with that answer.